This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Good morning.
Morning. Good morning.
Happy Buddha's birthday. This year, it's a confluence of cosmic events. It's a full moon and Passover and Easter and Buddha's birthday, all kind of landing in one spot. So if you're going to operate any magic, now's a good time. Generally, ordinary life is magic enough, but it's easy to overlook that. The pace of our life tends to be pretty rapid, especially in an urban setting. And the repetitive rhythms can obscure the miraculous. Not to mention the racket that goes along with urban life. And the exposure to that creates a kind of deadening. At least, it seems to me that it does. And in contrast, if you spend time in a kind of a monastic environment, there's also definitely a repetitive quality. But somehow the repetitive quality there tends to reveal something about the miraculous rather than obscure it. So that turning on the water faucet and seeing the water run can be kind of arresting. Rather than just sort of humdrum. Even though you do it many times a day. And yet, humans tend to collect in cities, we've noticed. This has been happening for a very long time, apparently. When I was in Japan, I found it remarkable that the Japanese seem to favor enormous cities. And they don't necessarily think that their cities are so enormous. The one time we went on begging rounds from the monastery, they took us to this city, I think it was called Matsuyama, which, you know, they didn't think it was a particularly big city, but anyway, we came over this hill, and it was just, it looked like Los Angeles to me. It's huge. But they thought, oh, no, it's just, you know, a city. And then after the begging rounds, we drove just a little ways inland, and couldn't have been more than 45 minutes inland from Matsuyama, and there was nobody. Mile after mile after mile of beautiful, fairly mountainous, forested countryside. Nobody. Everybody was out towards the coasts in these huge cities. So we tend to collect in places where we can get our hands on things that we need or want. And the price we pay, I think, is the environment can be kind of deadening to our senses. And as a result, sometimes we maybe don't feel so good. That deadening. We feel like we've lost touch with something. So we're in a little while we're going to welcome the baby Buddha again, as we do each year, and it's kind of interesting that around this time of year people also welcome the risen Jesus and various other traditions acknowledge the return of life, the upwelling of life. And in Buddhism, in particular, we're reminded that this return, this upwelling, this baby Buddha, the big challenge there is to see that as not dependent upon a person. And boy, is that a big challenge. So, you know, when Suzuki Roshi made a little remark like, "Well, just to be alive is enough," you know, it's pretty hard to appreciate the depth of that if we're still very attached to a particular person, namely ourself. And, I don't know about you, but I kind of am. And from a certain point of view, the remedy for that illness is to steady that self until its essentially vaporous quality becomes inarguable. And once that is so, your life is different. This is a story that there was a Chinese nobleman out hunting, riding around on his splendid horse, and as he was riding through the countryside, he saw a fellow sitting near a river, and he looked. He was dressed kind of like one of these Chan adepts, you know. And at first he thought, just, oh, here's some lunatic, because the guy had a fishing pole. So he appeared to be fishing, except he was about 30 feet from the water. So at first he thought, yeah, lunatic. But then he thought, oh no, he's dressed as a, he's like one of those Chan monks. So he thought, well, Chan lunatic, so maybe this is worth looking at here. So he stopped for a moment, and being a highborn Chinese nobleman, he expected to be noticed, but the Chan adept paid no attention. He just sat there with his fishing pole. And so the nobleman sat there a while, waiting to be noticed, until finally the horse began to wonder what the heck's going on here, snorted a few times. So the nobleman finally said, "Yo, Pops." And the Chan fellow paid no attention. So the nobleman said, "What you doing?" And the monk gave him a rather scornful look and said, "Fishing." And an old one said, "Aren't you kind of far from the water?" And the monk said, "Well, it's okay." And the nobleman said, "That's okay?" And the monk said, "Yeah, that's okay. I'm fishing with a straight hook." So the nobleman said, "How are you going to catch anything with a straight hook?" And the monk said, anybody know what the monk said?
"I caught you."
Not quite, but kind of. Anybody know what the monk said?
I'm drawing a blank. I've heard the story about it.
Yeah. I fish for the. I'm seeking the fish who turn away from life. Kind of interesting, no? So, I used to think that that meant necessarily that he was looking for those who go against the current of the world, which is certainly one way. But another way is that he's also looking for those, you might say, who were rejecting life. That is, those who were scorning life, despising life. And you see, you know, in the old texts, there's a kind of a current of that. If you look at the old Buddhist texts, there's kind of a almost a scornful tone towards life. And in our own world, sometimes people who have been quite injured or damaged, sometimes are very angry or have been very ill dealt with, have that feeling of scorning or turning away from life. And for those folks, sometimes only the straight hook will catch them. And a straight hook could be a Zen lunatic sitting fishing 30 feet from a river. Now, apparently the nobleman simply rode off, shaking his head. So he was not one to be caught by a straight hook. But the hook is in the story. And catches some of us to this day. So, Shakyamuni Buddha also fished, or fishes, with a straight hook. Mostly, he just seemed to walk around and talk to people and do his practice and beg for food and kind of catch people that way. As far as I know, he didn't I don't think he proselytized very much. So that was kind of a straight hook also. He just did what he did and lived his life, and people were drawn to that. So, kind of here too, our way is, we don't... at least I don't think we try to hook people. At least I hope not. And sometimes people will say, well, maybe we should try to hook people a little bit, because otherwise people won't, maybe they'll think we don't like them. Maybe we should extend the hand and be friendly and inviting, but not, try to rope people in or anything. Like those guys at, when I was a student at UC Berkeley, periodically someone would come up to you on campus and say, "Hi there, would you like to come have dinner with us?" And it was usually this really cute guy, and I was like sure, and it would turn out to be the Moonies, which was very disappointing. So that was like trying to hook people. So I don't think we should do that, but it's important to have a straight hook. Which means that people can, so to speak, catch themselves if they want. Catch themselves in the Buddha way. Find themselves in the resurgence of life in springtime, whenever they want. Meet the risen Jesus whenever they want. That the invitation is always there in them, always extended. This is the straight hook. free of advertising or coercion. Because otherwise there's something crooked about it. There's a barb on it someplace, and that's just not right. I don't think Buddha ever did that. In the old stories, at least as far as I know, somebody always asked him first, you know, said, "Hey, I'd like to join your gang." And then he would say, "Ehi, bhikkhu, come, look." So that's all I know about the straight hook. And I'm really grateful to all of you for being here. They're having a much bigger party over at 300 Page Street, and y'all could be there, but instead you're here. So I'm really grateful. It's really nice of you. And but we have a really nice cake.
Is that a hook?
Oops. Darn. It probably is.
It's a straight one.
It's a straight one. Have some questions or comments? Yeah, Ken.
At the beginning, thank you for your talk as always. At the beginning, you contrasted three times the monastic setting with the urban, and you used the word deadening, deadening. Mm. So it caused me to think of how the urban environment can not have that effect, also be a retreat, mm-hmm. in a sense, how to wake up in that rush of phenomena and noise and deadening from all the sensation.
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing that up, because it's something. And then I really love the other image of the monastery and turning the tap, and there's just the water and paying attention to that.
Yeah. And you can do that in the urban environment if you just think of it, you know. The problem is that the invitation to do so is sorely lacking unless you, or something reminds us, or we have a sangha that reminds us, or something. But the culture doesn't remind us.
No, it's a big challenge.
It's a big challenge. You know, or someone like Jennifer's around to remind us or something. You know. That's why it's good to have a sangha. I certainly need that. Or live in a place like Hartford Street, or have a home with an altar in it, or just something. You know, some Buddhist artwork. Or, eventually, lots of things will remind one. You know, a car horn, a door closing, bird call, a dog barking. All of these things can be reminders, eventually. But it takes some resensitizing, usually. Yeah. As it did for me, does for me.
I remember when you first moved here, I guess maybe you see the dogs would be barking.
Oh, Lord, yes.
Oh, my God, oh.
That could happen again, you know. Big, mean dog next door, that could be a challenge.
Because you did come here from Tassajara, wasn't
I did.
There, and then
I did.
Suddenly.
Straight from, environment. Almost straight from Tassajara, yeah.
So you didn't have, your nervous system was kind of...
Yeah, so now I'm slightly deadened, as appropriate for a dense and urban environment. So, it's, somebody, you know, complained to Suzuki Roshi about that, you know, having come from Tassajara. Mm-hmm. And that's one reason they bought 300 page, because people would come from Tassajara, and they're like, so they bought a place where people could, you know, kind of have at least a halfway house, sort of. And then people would say, you know, like, it's like, I'm like riding the bus and I feel like I have to have kind of like blinders on. And he said, well, that's kind of part of the price one pays for living in the city. You know, you kind of have to tone things down a little bit. If you live in the mountains all the time, no problem. But you have to kind of learn how to detune a little bit if you're going to live in an environment that's extremely intense. It's a useful skill, actually.
Yeah.
He just wanted to, you know, he said, I just wanted to live at Aheiji, but I couldn't get away with it.
Well, thank you for coming from the monastery to here for all of us.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, I actually kind of wanted to leave Tassajara. Kind of. I wasn't having as much fun there as I used to.
So you got desensitized to the turning the tap and the water?
Well, I was kind of thinking I could have more fun in my own place. I was wrong. But I was thinking that. So, I was young and foolish. Actually, I wasn't that young. I was 50-something. So.
That's young.
Is that young? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, maybe so.
This might be obvious, but is zazen an expression of the straight hook, a manifestation of the straight hook?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You could say the adept there, sitting with his fishing pole, too far from the water, would be an expression of that, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Too far to catch anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nothing to catch.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you very much. I was thinking when you were talking about the urban environment as having a deadening effect, then I was thinking that you can also have a deadening effect from other things from that. For instance, repetitive thinking, repetitive or unmindful activities that you repeat day in and day out, or
mm-hmm.
Patterns in relationships that don't work,
yeah.
that you continue day after day after day, can have a similar deadening effect no matter where you are.
Yeah, it's true. Mm-hmm.
And I think the remedy of that can be just the same as what you had offered for the remedy for being in the urban environment, which is to just take a minute and pay attention.
Yeah.
Practice.
Yeah. Even you know, monasteries can be full of people who have fallen prey to that, actually. Suzuki Roshi talks about losing the spirit of repetition, which you can certainly do in a monastery. And once you do that, he says, your practice will become very, very difficult. Even if you're in the greatest monastery in the world, you'll have a lot of trouble. So that's true. Yeah. that spirit of repetition means to find the freshness in it, even if it's something you've done 1,000 times.